It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later we'll be talking about a documentary exploring the life of a man who devoted his life to children living with HIV in India.
First, we're talking about another perspective on the newly implemented Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
Our guest works with an advocacy group trying to help inform people in Wisconsin about their options.
Bobby Peterson joins us now. He's founder and executive director for ABC for Health Incorporated. Bobby, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what do you think are some of the misconceptions about the Affordable Care Act, and what is your group doing to clear them up?
Well, we're doing a lot of education. We've done some training out there. I think there's a lot of confusion. It's a complicated law, but there are a lot of opportunities for people in Wisconsin. Between 500,000 and 700,000 people are potentially moving through different programs and coverages. I've called them healthcare refugees in some ways, looking for coverage and trying to identify it. But it's complicated, and every person's a little different, so simple answers don't usually work very well.
Are there any common denominators between the people who are the ones going, you know, online now and trying to find information about these federal exchanges?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, we know that in Wisconsin there's about 92,000 parents that are being terminated from the Badger Care Plus program. You know, those are folks that, you know, are getting their letters and they're concerned their kids are staying on the program. But they have to identify new coverage opportunities. They have to navigate a new bureaucracy that really hasn't been working too well these first few days. And I think we're confident it's going to pick up once the initial crush is over. But those are, you know, issues and questions that they're going to have to try and figure out what's best for themselves and their families. And hopefully they'll be able to find coverage that's in the same networks that their children are in, because that presents problems and difficulties. You have to work with one network for your kids and one for your parents, or for the parents.
Now, the people that you've been talking to so far, what has been the experience? What are you hearing?
I think people are, you know, having trouble getting into the marketplace right now. But, you know, we're telling people, look, you know, just take your time. It's not something that you have to jump on right away the first couple of days. Let the dust settle a little bit. One of the things that we really want people to be careful about is if they have health conditions that may be considered disabling. You know, just going into the marketplace might not be the best option for them. They should be reviewed and evaluated for disability coverage, because it might offer better coverage. And there's also a lot of disability programs out there that allow you to work with your disability. And a lot of people might not know that, but it's an option to consider. In Wisconsin, there's about 25,000 people in the high-risk pool, and that's called HRSP. And it's a program that was designed for people with pre-existing condition. Unfortunately, they were sort of segregated into that pool. Now they're going to be allowed to go into the new marketplace. But some of those folks might actually be in a position to evaluate disability coverage, and it might be a better option for them.
Now, as far as the demand has been and the traffic trying to move through these exchanges, would you say it's a bigger volume than expected, or how would you describe the volume of what's been happening out there?
Well, probably, you know, half the volume is reporters, bloggers, newsletter writers. You know, the first day the crush that we had was probably calls from reporters than from actual people. And I'm not kidding either. But there is a lot of movement out there. I think it's exciting. People are, you know, excited, I think, at the opportunity that healthcare coverage is soon going to be available to them. Remember, a lot of this is going to take a little bit more time. It seems like we've been waiting forever, but signing up for new coverages, there's an important December 15th deadline to get your enrollment done by then so your coverage can start on January 1st. But these are folks, some of them have been waiting in a long line. Our Wisconsin core plan had a waiting line of 163,000 people of our fellow, you know, citizens of Wisconsin waiting in a long line for health care coverage. Now many of those folks are going to actually be able to sign up and enroll in something and get the care that they need and deserve.
What is your sense of how the exchange system for the state of Wisconsin is working so far?
You know, it's bumpy, and we knew it would be bumpy at the beginning. But, you know, the long view is that there's a wide variety of health plan opportunities out there, different cost points. There are subsidies available for low-income and cost-sharing for low-income people, two different levels of support. The long view is that this is going to be very important for a lot of people to get coverage that they need at a premium they can afford, and you know, confidence that there are consumer protections built in here to help these folks. For a long time, people have been segregated into small little risk puddles, I like to say, and it didn't offer the sort of protection. It was you know, surrounded by a lot of fear. Now people are being able to use the exchange to get into a marketplace and into a larger pool, which makes people a lot more comfortable, and it's something that, you know, they're sharing with their other family, friends, and neighbors.
Well, it's certainly a time of transition. I know just watching the comments on the Central Time Facebook page, we've had people say, you know, it's making their blood pressure go up and their logins are ineligible, and they sound pretty frustrated with how it's working. And then on the other hand, you know, there's a comment saying, I called an 800 number. I got a lovely person here in America who knew just what I was talking about and helped me, and it was great. So it seems as though, you know, we're moving through a big transition here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I would just really urge people to, you know, if you're struggling to get in, you know, give it a day or two. Let some of the kinks get out of the system. You know, log in, you know, a little bit later. There's just too much of a crush right now. And some people are just window shopping, trying to understand what might be available. But there's a big push right now. It'll level off. There'll be plenty of opportunities to enroll and to get the coverage that you want.
Well, has the word gotten out there to people who are eligible, or are there people who still kind of don't know what's going on as far as their options go?
There are still people that don't know what's going on, and I think that, you know, that's the folks that we're trying to reach and make sure that they're aware of coverage opportunities to get affordable coverage and Medicaid as well. I mean, there's a new expanded program of Medicaid in Wisconsin for people below 100% of the federal poverty limit. And that's a big expansion. That's standard Medicaid, so it includes many of the services that people really need. And it's a great opportunity for people that have not had health care, sometimes for many years, to get in, to get physicals, to get evaluated, and to start getting the medications and other things that they need to help support a better lifestyle.
What is the plan, you know, if any, in place to locate the people who could slip through the cracks, who don't know about the program and who don't know how to sign up?
Well, it's a big gap, and it's a big gap particularly here, you know, in Wisconsin. We do have, you know, some bright spots, but in other states like Maryland, for example, the state allocated $25 million to help outreach, education, and support. In Wisconsin, you know, those activities are largely unfunded. It's groups doing the best they can with very limited budgets. The federal government supported some Navigator grants, but parts of the state really don't have coverage, even though the Navigator grants were supposed to have no wrong door and everybody was supposed to be able to get help. There's big chunks of the state that there isn't a locally available Navigator. There are enrollment networks that each of the county consortium have developed, and those are sprinkled around the state. In the Dane County area, it's the Capital Consortium. Other parts of Milwaukee has a consortium, and those are helpful, and those are groups of dedicated folks who are really working together to try and identify opportunities to teach, train, and connect people to the coverage that they need.
Now, somebody's listening right now, and it's someone who needs a little extra help navigating the system. What would you tell them?
I mean, at first I would say, you know, maybe, you know, if you're getting frustrated by logging in, give it another day or two. I mean, really, just try and be patient. You might, you know, take a look at what your income level is. If you don't have much income at all, you're unemployed, you might think, and you don't have any children, you might be eligible for some of the Medicaid coverage that's available for below 100%. If you're losing coverage because your kids are on Badger Care Plus and you were on it, again, you know, you've got a little bit of time, but take a look at the networks that are out there on the marketplace. You know, it probably is a good idea to try and stay in the same health plan that your kids are in, just to save yourself, you know, a little frustration. Most of the Badger Care Plus networks are also networks that are available within the marketplace. I mean, they're different. They're a commercial plan versus the Medicaid Badger Care plan, but they're the same provider. So that's a key thing to take a look at. And as you're looking, make sure you identify, you know, the physicians that you're currently working with or that you have worked with, and make sure they're a part of that network, because you want to promote the continuity of care and the people that you've been working with. If you like them, maybe you don't. But if you've had, you know, if you want to maintain that connection with your providers, that's a good thing to do too.
All right. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Bobby Peterson, founder and executive director of ABC for Health Incorporated.
Coming up, we're talking about a documentary screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival next week. It's about a man who gave up pretty much everything to work with kids living with HIV in India.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're in the midst of the Milwaukee Film Festival, and we're going to focus now on one of the selections at this year's event. It's a story of a man who set his life aside to work with children living with HIV in India.
This is Steve Hoover's feature film debut. It's about his longtime friend, Rocky Bratt, who went to India. Before we introduce Steve, let's give a listen to Rocky talking.
I was never intending to go to the AIDS orphanage. It was never my plan. I didn't really like kids, to be honest with you. So I thought the orphanage would be like stupid, like kind of like going to a daycare or something. And I thought, oh, I'll see these kids and I'll move on. But being there, seeing that they're in despair and they're hopeless and you're like, man, they're kids, you know, watching them cry. As they got closer to you, sharing like, yeah, I don't have a mother, I don't have a father. Every child desires a mother and father so much. I was really moved by the kids. These photo books that I saw, all these faces, different visitors from all over the world. They've been seeing faces their whole lives, just people who are in and out. And I was like, man, I don't want to just be a face in the book.
That was Rocky Bratt talking the documentary Blood Brother. Now we'll talk to the director, Steve Hoover. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So you talk about this as a film about your best friend. And watching it, I mean, Rocky is just, he's like a guy, right? He's just a normal guy. What is it that got into him to say on this trip through India, I'm going to hang it up and I'm going to work with these kids?
You know, it's interesting. I definitely think it's the relationships he built with the kids. I mean, in some sense, it was unintended. There's a lot of things that didn't quite fit into the film. But one thing that happened was the first week that Rocky was actually there and he spent time with the kids, he hated India. And he and his friend that he was with booked flights for Australia, and they were just going to go spend the rest of the summer on the beach. And he said, as they were leaving, they were taking a train to the airport, that he was kind of overcome with this feeling that he was making a mistake, you know, because of the relationships he had already kind of started to build with the kids. So they canceled their flights and went back to the orphanage and spent the rest of the summer, you know, with the kids and with the aunties at the home there. So I think it was just, you know, the realization of they can't turn off their situation. They can't change it on their own power, but he could influence it.
Let's back up and talk about you and Rocky. How long had you known him at this point?
Rocky and I actually met in 2001, around the fall of 2001. We met in Pittsburgh at the Art Institute. We were both studying and happened to live on the same floor right across from each other. So he had basically introduced himself to me, and we became friends at that point. And eventually got an apartment and lived together for about 7 years.
And did he strike you as the guy most likely to move to India and work at an orphanage for kids with HIV?
No, I wouldn't say that. He was a really passionate graphic designer. I always imagined us kind of, you know, we did everything together. So I imagined we would, wherever he lived, I would live, and we'd be pursuing our careers. He was adventurous, but I mean, I never would have imagined him being where he is now and doing what he's doing.
So how did you get the word from him that, you know, he was on this tour, you knew about that, he was in India, and all of a sudden you find out that he's going to stay there? How did he tell you that, and what was your reaction?
Well, he actually told me in person, because the first time he went, he spent a summer there, and I thought he was only going for a couple weeks. He did buy a one-way ticket, but when he didn't come back after a couple weeks, he sort of just sent an email, hey, I'm staying here for the summer. Okay. So then, you know, he came back after that summer, and you could tell there was something different, and he just said, I'm going to move there. I told the kids I'd be back in a year. I'm going to save up. I'm going to sell everything I have, and I'm going to go. And obviously, I just didn't really know why he was so impacted, because I had no firsthand experience with the kids or what he experienced. But watching him, you know, he hung pictures of the kids all over the walls. He was sending them packages. He put a calendar basically for every month leading up until the day that he committed to moving, and every day he would cross it off. So it was interesting to watch him go through something that I just had no connection with.
What made you want to document this in Blood Brother?
Well, there's when I was in school, you know, Rocky and I also sharing an apartment, we shared a room, and we'd talk about, you know, falling asleep at night, talk about our just different dreams, things we wanted to do. And I used to tell him that one of my dreams was to do some sort of documentary in a third world or developing third world, and I didn't really even understand what that meant. It was just kind of a young dream. And I just never pursued it because, you know, I was pursuing my career in Pittsburgh, commercial directing and music video directing. And it's just kind of one of those things. A year after he had been there, he was started to get established. He was sending me emails, updating me on his experiences. Some of them were tragic. Some of them were really funny. And I just tried to picture him there. And I know, you know, knowing Rocky, I know he's a character. He's entertaining. He's always been entertaining to me as a friend. And I was just very curious to finally see, you know, what my best friend was doing, because, as I said, I had no connection with it. So it's kind of like the planets kind of aligned in my head. And, I had the resources, and I was like, you know what? I need a break from the typical production I've been working on, and I have this, you know, I've always wanted to do this. You know, I should just do it.
Well, and then then you did it. You went to the orphanage, and you're telling Rocky's story, but you're also telling the story of the kids at this orphanage. Can you talk about them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rocky's story was very important because it's, you know, he's a connection to these kids, and he has a lot of backstory, and he's, you know, as I said, he's a character. But the kids were also really important because they're this whole, you know, they're sort of like the love story in the film, I guess, is seeing the relationship he has with the kids. And for me, you know, I was impacted by the kids because they were different than what I expected. They were filled with joy. They were happy. You know, they're very normal kids going to school, enjoying life when they, you know, weren't being affected by their condition. And I just learned a lot through them as well, you know, watching them take their medication and watching them live their lives. You know, they were also, as a whole, to me, they were characters. So they were just obviously largely important to Rocky's story and to the overall story.
So these are kids living with HIV in an orphanage in India. As we heard Rocky describe it, they had these cherished picture books of people who came and went. They'd visited for a while, worked there for a while, and then left. What did the kids think of Rocky, this guy who did his best to stay as much as he could?
I think initially, as Rocky describes it, it was hard for them to just kind of open up and fully trust him. You know, they would give him, I guess the best way to say it is, they would give him a piece of their heart, kind of. And as he continued to show that he was committed and that he wasn't going to leave, they ended up, you know, they trusted him more and more. And you can see that in person. And even in the film, I'm sure, you know, how the kids are just kind of drawn to Rocky. You can tell they trust him. You can tell they see him as family.
Their lives, they don't, again, people coming in and out of them for in the adult world, but also, as you show in the film, these kids, they die. They have HIV. They're in very poor health. How does that affect their ability, as you saw, to make connections with each other and with the adults in their lives?
I think especially early on it was more difficult. With the introduction of the medication that they take, their lives have been lasting longer. I think the home was initially started as sort of a rest stop in between, you know, their normal lives and death. So I think that, as Rocky would share early on, especially in some of his journals and emails, it was even more difficult because the kids, they would watch, you know, one of the others go off to the hospital and just kind of wonder, am I next? And they still think that, you know, their health has improved a lot, but still when one of the kids gets sick, you know, they all kind of wonder, am I next? And that definitely affects their relationships. Because they've all had extremely broken relationships. Most, you know, they're all there because their world was basically shattered, the small world that they had, and they had to sort of forge a new family. So I think it's difficult, but, you know, they ultimately, they want to have family. They want to be connected with people, and so they learn to give their hearts and to trust.
We're talking to Steve Hoover. He's director of the documentary Blood Brother. It's about his friend who moved to India to work with kids who have HIV in an orphanage. The film's screening on the closing night of the Milwaukee Film Festival next Thursday, October 10th.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll continue our conversation now with Steve Hoover. He's director of the documentary Blood Brother. It's about his friend, Rocky, who, on a trip in India and elsewhere, decided to sell everything he had, move back, and work at an orphanage for children living with HIV there. Steve, we've heard a lot about Rocky. Tell us more about maybe one or two of the kids you met while you were there filming the documentary. What were their stories?
You know, it's interesting. There's every kid has just a loaded story. Naturally, one of the kids who, you know, is featured in the film a lot, Sudia, you know, he was a kid I really connected with. But there was one family in particular who was also in the film, and the mother of the girl, her name is Deepa, the girl, her mother's name is Lata, and she has a twin brother named Deepak. Their story was really interesting to me because when Lata found out that she was HIV positive, her husband told her, apparently, I'm not exactly clear how he had contracted it, but it obviously wasn't a positive situation. They were very frightened about the stigma, and so he wanted to basically, with his wife, they wanted to commit suicide so as not to deal with the effects of HIV. But she convinced him not to, and they shortly found out that they were pregnant. And again, he encouraged her to have an abortion because he didn't want the kids to be born with AIDS. And she basically swore to her husband that she would take care of her babies if anything happened to him. But before doing that, she actually went forward with the abortion, but it didn't work. This is in the film, and you basically find out that at that time, they didn't realize that they were pregnant with twins. Shortly after that, Lata's husband died, and she gave birth to Deepa and Deepak, and she actually has three kids to her husband, and all three of them are HIV negative. So it's a really incredible story that almost ended very tragically. But that was one story that really stuck with me. And, you know, Deepa and Deepak are great kids. But there's, you know, there's so many kids in the actual orphanage that are HIV positive that have tragic backgrounds. And as I said, they all have just really intense stories.
And it was, watching parts of it, it was very emotionally intense. Watching Rocky, do you get the sense that he's always able to hold it together living there?
Yeah, you know, Rocky does his best to really hold it together. I mean, we've been in situations where, especially taking care of Sudia, where I know if he wasn't there, I would have given up. And sometimes I'm just like, man, how does he do it? But yeah, Rocky does a great job of holding it together. And when he needs to break down, he does. I think he's, in a healthy way, he's really in touch with his emotions and just ways to handle the different kinds of trauma that he encounters. It has an effect on him, for sure. But I see him handling things well.
The theme, I think, of the film is, as I read it, anyway, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's about finding family. Rocky felt disconnected in some ways with his own family, and of course the kids at the orphanage have a changing cast of characters wandering through. Do you feel like there was a family among these kids and Rocky and the other people working there?
Yeah, there's definitely a family, a sense of family when you're with them, and especially when you see the kids and how they respond to Rocky. And what he said in the film, you know, the kids started calling me daddy. It's true. And, you know, the last time I went, my wife and I spent 5 weeks with him. You know, it was interesting to see the kids calling him daddy. And he has become such a stable, probably the most consistent, stable relationship that the kids have, the ones that have been there since Rocky has been coming, that they trust him and they see him as family and they know that he's not leaving. So you definitely get the sense of family.
And I don't want to spoil anything here, but one of the last parts of the movie is a wedding. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Rocky had met a girl, Nimi, and, you know, it was an interesting thing. It was something I was deeply curious about because my friend was basically starting to plan and talk about marrying a woman I had never met. And it's interesting, the first time you see Nimi in the film is when, that was the first time I had ever met her, the first time you see her face. So, and that was, you know, shortly before their marriage. Definitely a different process than I and most of us here in the U.S. are familiar with. But Nimi, she's a really awesome woman. They're very happy together. And, you know, she's got a heart for the children as well. She tutors the kids every evening. She's basically employed through the orphanage to tutor the kids. It's not a large income by any means, but she's very engaged, and she plays the role that Rocky really wanted, someone who would have a heart for the girls in the home and the girls and young women, because he felt like they had special needs that he wouldn't be able to meet, and he really feels confident that Nimi fills that role.
Now, when I think of, you know, an orphanage for children with HIV in India, obviously sad, I guess, is the first emotion that pops into my head. You mentioned earlier you saw a lot of joy there. Can you talk about the joy and the happiness that you saw there, too?
Yeah, the kids were they're just so grateful to have people come, and that's one thing. And then to come and stay for a while, you know, they really, they pour themselves into you. I mean, I think by the third trip, I'd gotten to know them a lot better because they had seen, okay, maybe this guy will be more of a consistent person in my life, and Rocky loves and trusts him, so I can as well. But the kids, you know, as I shared earlier, they're living normal lives. You know, they have fun, they play. And apart from, at times they'll have, you know, emotional challenges just dealing with their past. Overall, they're happy kids. And it's not just the kids there. I think it was something I realized about just India in general, because we spent some time in the slums as well, because, you know, Rocky had made friends with people there. And my expectations were that people would be sad and depressed and you know, I'm basing it off of my Western perspective going in. But as I shared in the film, I found the opposite.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on the show.
That was Steve Hoover, director of the documentary Blood Brother. It's screening on the closing night of the Milwaukee Film Festival, Thursday, October 10th.
And the film will also be screening in Madison for one night on October 15th at Star Cinema in Fitchburg. For more information about the film Blood Brother or the Milwaukee Film Festival, we have links up on our Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR.
Stick around. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time.
Coming up after 5, Dr. Neil Bernard joins us to talk about nutrition and brain health.
First, Mike Cole is a fiction author. He's written a number of books in the Shadow Ops series. He's also done 3 tours in the military in Iraq, and he was recalled to serve during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I stumbled across an essay he wrote a while back about PTSD and how we talk about it and think about it, so we got in touch with him. And he joins us now. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you started the essay I mentioned by saying that writing about your PTSD is going outside your comfort zone. Is it hard for you to write about it and talk about it?
I mean, it's funny. I picked up habits from working in the cleared space. When you work in an area that requires a security clearance, you know, mental health is an issue that can cause that to be revoked. And having that revoked isn't just the end of a job, it's the end of a career. And while the agencies that you work for tell you that it's fine, and in the end it was in my case, it's really hard to get past that thematic culture. And you sort of learn in a deep-rooted way that really isn't something you talk about unless you absolutely have to.
Well, there has been a lot of talk about PTSD since the U.S. entered wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. What do we get wrong when we talk about it?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I think PTSD, and mind you, I'm not a medical professional by any stretch of the imagination, is a lot like autism. We've identified it as a thing, but we don't really know what it is. And we see a lot of treating classic symptoms of it, such as reliving the event or numbness or hypervigilance. But the reality of it is that was never my experience, and it was also never the experience of any of the other people that I talked to. I'm not trying to say that that is never the experience, but I think that people have a really hard time admitting that they don't know, and it's much easier to slap a diagnosis on it and to give it a medical definition than it is to tackle the breadth and depth of what's a really complex thing.
I want to get into living with PTSD a little more in a minute, but I want to read a quote from your piece talking about the cause of PTSD as you experienced it, and here's the quote. "It was never the snap trauma, the quick moment of action that breaks a person. PTSD is the wages of a life spent in crisis, the slow thematic build that gradually changes the way the sufferer sees the world." Talk about that. Expand on that a little.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, is before I was diagnosed, I would have told you you were crazy. I think I really didn't feel like I had a right to PTSD. I felt like that was a thing that was the province of hard operators. You know, I was working with people in Iraq who were up to their elbows in blood, who were in firefights every single day. That wasn't my experience. How could I possibly have PTSD? But the truth is that it really is a slow build, and that when you spend your entire life in a crisis zone, and that isn't just for vets, and it isn't just for warfighters, that's EMTs, that can be people in abusive relationships or people who grow up in poverty, you change slowly in a lot of very fundamental ways. And what ends up is that your worldview changes, and it changes so fundamentally that you occupy the world in a different way from people who don't have the same experiences as you. And that dissonance, that disconnect from the rest of society, I really think is the thing that we're calling PTSD. And it's very important to see it that way, because that defies the traditional medical taxonomy as a disease. A disease is a discrete thing. You take a pill, you go through a course of treatment, even in the case of a chronic disease. But how do you treat a shift in perspective?
Yeah, you write that it's not just a disease, it's an altered worldview.
That's correct. Yeah, I firmly believe that. It's look, I think that when you grow up in an industrialized Western society, you grow up with a certain sense of a feeling of connectedness and a feeling of significance and a feeling of safety. And when that gets stripped away, and I don't mean, you know, stripped away in some tangential way, but fundamentally stripped away, the way you occupy the world changes. And more importantly, your life goals change. And when those goalposts move, you really are fundamentally cut off from people who don't have the same experience.
You mentioned not thinking that you were somebody who would have PTSD because you weren't in that snap trauma kind of experience. Why did you get diagnosed, and what was your reaction when you got diagnosed?
Well, I mean, I certainly had snap trauma experiences, okay. But none of those resulted in a sudden break. I don't want to get too personal. I underwent some real serious dark times in my life, among which included, you know, severe depression, severe anxiety, losing my fiance. And I finally reached a point where my father and my brother and my best friend were screaming at me and saying, "You've got to get help." And I always pounded the security clearance, I can't. And when I finally hit bottom, and I did, and I started working with someone, and he started walking back the cat on my experiences, and he finally said, this is classic PTSD. You know, at first I didn't believe him. At first I thought he was he was a quack or something. But as we sat and worked through it, I started to realize that I hadn't really understood what this illness was. And that misunderstanding had arisen largely from the messages I was getting from the military. I never forget, there's this Armed Forces Network commercial they had of this guy washing his hands and the sink is running with blood and he sees corpses in the background and his vision turns red. And that was what I thought PTSD was. And it just not only was it not my experience, but that hasn't been the experience for anyone else I've talked to about it.
That's one of the tricky things about it, isn't it? It sounds like, from your experience and the people you've talked to, it's hard to have a one-size-fits-all concept of what PTSD is.
And I think that's the real danger of it. I mean, if I had to define my own PTSD, I would describe it as being unmoored from what makes life significant for most of the population. Your goals change, and what makes life meaningful to you changes, and it changes permanently, and it changes fundamentally. And for me, what's helped has been treating that by setting new goals and charting a new path through life. And that's a course of treatment I haven't seen prescribed through any traditional channel I've dealt with. And I think it's an important thing to be considered, because once I wrote that essay, I'm hearing a lot from other people who agree with me. And I'm sure this is a small sampling of the sufferers, but you know, when you get that kind of affirmation, you feel that maybe there's something to it.
What is it like to make the transition from a life lived in crisis, or the constant risk of being in a crisis situation, to everyday life back here in the United States?
At first, it's the most isolating thing I can possibly describe to you. I'll never forget going out to dinner or going to a restaurant or having conversations and thinking, who are these people? You know, and trying to spend 8 hours in an air-conditioned office looking at a spreadsheet or a PowerPoint presentation after you've been spending 18 hours a day on a battlefield, it's boring and it feels meaningless. But really the thing in the end was the isolation, the feeling that you are completely, completely alone in it. And obviously that's not the case, because plenty of people have suffered from it. But it takes a while to get connected to that community. And that isolation is a really dangerous spot to be in.
Well, and it's got to maybe not be that worthwhile to talk to someone like me who hasn't been in that situation. But when you started talking to other people who had PTSD, who were going through what you were, did that help? Did that break that isolation, do you think?
Absolutely. And the thing that's so funny is that I became connected to them not through veterans communities, but through the arts. And what I discovered in New York City is that there's a huge population. There's a society I'm a part of called Sock Art Vets. And it's a whole population of vets, many of whom are PTSD sufferers, who are trying to find things to live for and trying to find ways to reinvent themselves and new goalposts, as I described. And art is a huge piece of that for all of us. And ironically enough, it wasn't Real Warriors and it wasn't Wounded Warrior. It was the arts that gave me that network.
So you talked about goal setting as part of your path to dealing with life outside of that crisis zone. What goals did you start setting?
Well, there's a few of them. And one thing that I did do that I wanted to point out, which is common of many PTSD sufferers, is I went right back into crisis. My day job is with the police department, and I'm an officer in the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve. And the U.S. Coast Guard, unlike other reserve organizations, we don't just train to fight. We do search and rescue and law enforcement every time we drill. So I stay in that crisis zone. And I think that there's two major things that have helped me create new goalposts. One is to quote Neil Gaiman, to make great art. And I know that may seem silly, but for me it means a lot, because it's a way of marking the world. And it's a way of feeling myself resonate in the world the same way I did when I was at war. And the other thing is continuing to serve in crisis occupations. I am frightened every second of every day of my life. And the thought that there might be one person out there who's not feeling that way because they know I'm on watch, I may be kidding myself, that may be idealistic, but it helps me get to bed at night.
And let's talk about writing fiction. Now, I know you're doing it as a career too. It's not a therapy practice for you, but Does it have a therapeutic element?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because remember what I said to you before about PTSD, it being isolating. Writing, I'm not Emily Dickinson. I write to communicate. I send things out into the world. And I write fantasy. And the wonderful thing about the science fiction and fantasy community is there is such a tight integration between authors and fans. Almost all authors in that community come up out of fandom. So you send what you're doing out in the world and people come back to you. And yeah, I guess part of that's ego boo, but a lot of it is knowing that you exist and knowing that you're still connected and knowing that when you look at people and you can't understand why they're getting excited over goals that have ceased to have meaning for you, you're still connected and you're still having resonance in the universe.
Speaking of the fantasy and science fiction world, the piece you wrote that we're talking about, part of what led up to it was an essay on one of the favorite book series here at Central Time, Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones. You wrote about a couple characters who you recognized PTSD in. What was it like to talk about PTSD through the lens of those fictional characters?
I mean, this is the great thing about science fiction and fantasy, right? It allows you to address topics that are close to you at a remove, which makes them a lot more accessible. But what I really liked about that was in the characters of Arya Stark and Theon Greyjoy, I was able to address both sides of PTSD. And this is another misconception, I think, is that PTSD is universally debilitating. It is also enfranchising. And there is a lot about living in a state of hypervigilance. And there is a lot about having your goalposts move that levels up your life and doesn't just hold you back. And this is, again, where I mean that it's a thing that's not well understood, is that there's a lot of facets to it. And again, I'm not a medical professional, but there's things like that enfranchisement that I just don't see being addressed in the literature.
Last words of the piece we're talking about, you directed to other people with PTSD, whether veterans, EMTs, police, people who've lived with abusive relationships. Last three words of your essay, don't give up.
No, don't. And this is the thing, is that, I mean, I won't lie. In the beginning, I really don't know what kept me going. But, and this is chronic. This is never going to leave me. And there's always bad days. But the reality of it is I am so, so happy with where my life has wound up. And I am doing so many things I never thought I'd get to do. And if I had given up, and man, did I come close, I would have missed this. And that would have been a tragedy.
Mike, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Mike Cole. He's author of novels, including a number of books in the Shadow Ops series. He's an Iraq War veteran. I've got a link to his piece, his essay on PTSD, at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, Dr. Neil Bernard joins us to share nutritional advice to boost our brain health. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.